This is CliffCentral.com.
Right now, what I want to do is welcome Devin Moonsami here, the CEO of the ICHAF Training Institute. We're going to talk a little bit about an article which raised a few eyebrows. Racism and sexism are offensive, so what? It's a heated topic, but I want to find out straight from him what he meant by it, and especially because this is not the kind of topic that gets you anything but opprobrium from some quarters. And Devin is a businessman. We'll find out a little bit about what he's up to at the moment. But have we as a society become too easily outraged? Are we too emotional when it comes to some of the problems we face? And I looked at a story that came up yesterday about Katy Perry's shoes. Did you see this story, Sia? So Katy Perry brought out a pair of shoes. One pair is sort of tan-colored and one pair is black. And they've got faces on them. And they actually had to pull these shoes off the shelves because certain people were so offended that the black ones were blackface. They didn't comment on the tan ones. But is that a more or less decent summary of what happened there? Because it was just the most stupid thing I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, it also follows on Gucci recently, who was also in the news. Gucci, the design house, released a polo neck, a black polo neck. And as you know, with the polo neck goes right up to the neck. And so with this particular jersey, you could pull the neck part a little higher so that it goes over the mouth.
Which a lot of people in Arctic climates, like America's gone through in the last couple of weeks, would like to do just to protect their ears and their mouth and their nose from the cold.
So with that, the fact that you could pull it over the mouth and it had red lips on the actual jersey.
People thought
people
it was like
also saying that what Gucci's doing is also blackface, and Gucci has pulled that off as well, and now Katy Perry's in the middle of deciding how to respond.
Well, blackface is the new extreme position to not discuss. I mean, it's just not even, you can't even discuss this. The Democratic governor of Virginia and his lieutenant governor have both been in trouble. The governor himself over dressing up like supposedly Michael Jackson somewhere in the 80s. He says Michael Jackson, and he was ready to do the moonwalk to prove it. Thank God his wife stopped him just before that happened, because my God, it would have been embarrassing. But Devin, it's first of all a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in to see us.
Thank you very much for having me, Devin.
Have you got a lot of blowback from this article?
Yeah, I have. So people have been writing. In fact, I'm not uncomfortable with people writing to me about some of the things that I've written about, because it does happen quite a bit. I like to focus on subjects that are traditionally taboo around the subject of racism and classism. So for me, I'm comfortable with writing it, and I'm also comfortable with the feedback.
All right, but with these situations I've just described, and I wasn't going to go into such a long description of the problem, but this is ridiculous. It's got ridiculous. Like Katy Perry's shoes, the horrible shoes. By the way, they're the worst shoes. I don't know how anyone could wear them. Mm-hmm. And any woman who did would probably deserve to be, looked at askance by people in the street for wearing such terrible shoes just because Katy Perry designed them. I mean, they looked like they were put together by three-year-olds in a sweatshop somewhere.
Yeah.
But it's not blackface. Mm. And this obsession with being offended, mm-hmm. it's recreational offense, mm-hmm. Is something that social media has brought to us, right?
Yeah, you'll see what's happened in the last decade, or possibly the last, a little bit more than that, and most predominantly in this last decade, is that we've had more and more levels of awareness around people becoming offended by things like the shoes, by the balaclava, like the Gucci incident that he just spoken about. So we didn't see this 20, 30, 40 years ago, firstly because we weren't connected in the social media space in the way in which we connected now. So therefore, people didn't have an outlet and a platform. So you'll have to wait till, like a Sunday lunch so that you can express your dissatisfaction with what somebody did. Now what's going on is people are in a desperate, I would almost say they're desperate to get their voices to be heard. They're using different platforms. I would say on one level, there's high people are looking at sensationalizing different aspects or elements of the way in which they perceive the world to be.
But isn't it also just an addiction to attention? Like, if I say I'm offended, I expect people to care. And most people don't really, yeah. do they? I mean, I don't care if you're offended. You don't care if I'm offended, do you?
Look, Gareth, it's different for every individual. So for 7 billion people in the world, everybody will have a different interpretation of what they're offended by
right.
and what it is you say to me now will push my button or not. So let's say, for example, you say something to me that may refer to my very dark skin as an Indian South African person.
Right.
And somebody with the same melanin production pigment sitting next to me may be completely offended by what it is you're saying. It's my perception in terms of how I'm receiving that message. I was never there when things were difficult for you. I was never there when you were ostracized or you were put down.
Yeah, but nobody is. And people don't actually, they don't have the sensitivity to care about these things. Like most people go through their lives, they're totally self-absorbed.
Mm.
And then we expect everyone else to care about us.
And the problem with that is that it was my experience, my prejudice, my inhibition, my low self-esteem, whatever it is, whatever is happening in that moment, it is something that's intrinsic and personal, a relationship that I have with it.
Mm-hmm.
And expressing it sometimes is where the lost in translation comes from.
Right.
So somebody who is offended by what it is you're saying, there are deep, I mean, you're looking at people who are on tweeting, maybe she's got 25 years of baggage
yeah.
or 30 years of experiences around black shoes or around a balaclava. That sounds ridiculous to us, but she may have been traumatized in, you know, based on that particular piece of clothing.
Sure. Triggered is the word.
Triggered. Mm-hmm. So to really dig deeper and ask the question, you know, is everybody offended by this? Unfortunately, it's an easy question to ask and a very difficult one to answer, because we've got to have a census with 7 billion people and a therapy session with each individual for a good few hours to try and determine where these anxieties comes from. Low self-esteem is a driver. Lack of self-confidence is a driver. So people who express themselves by obliterating your content of character or express themselves and openly lambaste you or him or the next person, it suggests something about your own character. So we must look for subtle hints and signs in terms of the way the criticism is being expressed. Is it factual? Is it something that I've thought up based on my anxieties and inhibitions? And I am of the opinion, in the decade I've been doing this around the subject of diversity and inclusion, it's a lot of our own preconceived notions, our own judgments and ideas that I sometimes project onto you.
So a psychologist would have a field day.
I would imagine so, yes.
Isn't it great to be a psychologist now, because you've got so much raw material? You can observe people like experimental animals.
Yeah.
Social media has allowed us, in Twitter's case, into people's heads, into their thoughts, their reactions, their behavior. Facebook has also, to a degree, let us into that, but it's also let us into the kind of world that they want you to think they inhabit.
Yeah.
And people falsify their experiences to try and be popular, which is a whole other dimension to this.
Gareth, they do. And the sad reality is sometimes, you know, in a moment of weakness or despair, we sometimes tap into a space where I'm telling the truth on Twitter, where I'm expressing myself explicitly. And, you know, sometimes when after it's been shared, you can't untweet it. You know, you can't go back and go, oh, well, you know, I can't really say that anymore. Because already an audience of 100 people who shared it with another 100, they've already assessed the content of character.
Mm.
And it's very difficult taking back. And you see, it's in sentences, it's in facial expressions, in gestures.
Mm.
We can express ourselves. I mean, you would know that I don't like you just based on, you know, a simple, you know, gesture or a glance,
yeah.
or, you know, and the way in which I'm approaching the situation. And often people in those moments assess another person's character and then go write about it based on the engagement, based on the interaction.
But also, you know, intention's important here.
Mm.
And you mentioned how you can't take back a tweet, for example. I mean, we saw Kevin Hart, who was going to host the Oscars, and now we've got no host for the Oscars, and it's going to be the most boring Oscars ever. And Hollywood's punishing itself with its political correctness. But they dug up some tweet from, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago,
yeah.
where he said something that was mildly homophobic.
Yeah.
And there are degrees. Like, you know, seriously homophobic is throwing gay people off a roof in an Islamist country.
Yes.
Mildly homophobic is making a fag joke with your friend who isn't gay.
Yeah.
You know, there are different degrees. And to some people, they're all the same. To some people, words are violence and, you know, they're triggered, like you were discussing earlier about the woman with the shoes or the balaclava, for example. And there's no distinction between the different kinds of offense.
Mm.
I mean, we should all be offended by racism. And sexism and and misogyny and homophobia at its worst, because that's the stuff that drives humanity backwards and down. But I think there's also a conversation that needs to be had around people who are mischaracterized because of intention being bad. And this is what I wanted to ask you about. So in the Kevin Hart case, the intention of someone who's digging up a tweet like that is not an intention of, let's be objective about Kevin, he's a funny guy, he might make some offhand comments, like all comedians do, that may or may not be judged out of context to be terrible comments. But there's no forgiveness here. There's no ability for us to ascertain the intent of the person who seems to be virtue signaling online for points because they've discovered someone else's evil. What's that all about?
Now, you see, if you try and dig deeper to understand what the person's intention is, we cannot say. The only individual that can comment is the person who actually went through the process of digging. If somebody wanted to lambaste you publicly, they'd probably go very, very deep and try and find things, whether it's true, whether it's not. Some have even been known to go to childhood friends to try and determine. You see, people do that. What drives this behavior could be a number of different things. I sometimes in my programs always refer to the conversation that we have with ourselves. What are we saying to ourselves right now about our behavior? How I behaved with you yesterday, how I spoke to you this morning. Am I reflecting on how comfortable? Did I bring you closer as a colleague, or did I push you away, and is there a lack of trust now between us? But you see, what happens is, when an individual reacts in this way and an organization gets wind of it, the organization has its brand identity to protect. So if they're not seen as being proactive, it almost gives a voice to some lonely, bored person who decided to go and who's got, and everybody, everyone's an Instagram model. So everyone has, you know, 2,000 followers, 5,000, 10,000 followers. You know, housewives have 11,000 followers these days.
Yeah.
So everybody has a voice. So when we post something controversial enough, then you do have your following. Somebody will go, and then an organization is then held accountable. What did you do about it? What did you do about it? So if I do something completely offensive here and say something to one of your producers, you then would have to take a stance, because what did Cliff Central do about it? Yes, we have. Devin is a racist. We know that. He said that. But what did the organization do about it? Then you become measured. Yeah. Based on my insecurity.
Yeah, we could have the BLF pitch up and protest outside our doors, or worse.
Yes, correct.
So, you've written a number of books about this, but before we get into the books, because I want to give them a decent plug, I think people should be reading them at this time. Let's just get into the ICHAF and the Training Institute that you're the CEO of. What is that?
It's called, the acronym stands for the I Can Help Africa Training Institute. And we are a CETA accredited training provider, so we're a private TVET college. Now, I started the company about 10 years ago, and I must say, completely blessed, Gareth. Mm-hmm. Well, firstly, I'm blessed meeting you today, because I really am a keen follower.
Don't go and butter me up, you racist classist sexist.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Definitely not. Well, okay, I'm buttering you up, because I'd love to be a guest again.
Yeah, sure.
But I started this...
Makes sense, and we'll have you back.
Yeah, started this show. I almost said I started this show. I mean, I started the company 10 years ago, and we are accredited by the Department of Education, which means we go into different corporates and we train them in the areas of learnerships and other skills development areas, communication skills, customer service, etc. And in the last, I'd say about 5 or 6 years, more and more of these companies. So we've been quite blessed in that we've had big corporates who've been engaging with us,
right,
and the company has grown in terms of number and client base, etc. And more of these companies started asking me if I could facilitate a dialogue around racism. And I wasn't at the stage familiar enough with the subject to be able, although I'd been studying psychology, etc., I didn't think I was the right person to engage in these discussions about who's racist and who's not. So around that time, I started this discussion with different companies, and now I can't imagine my life without it. A day in the life of me is going to an organization and chairing discussions and sitting in corrective reviews with people who've behaved who've expressed open racism, people who've had subtle racism, gender, sexuality.
Oh, it seems to be happening all over. So your work is very important in South Africa because this has become a minefield. Mm. And for companies to negotiate their way, I mean, most companies don't exist to be the proxy mommy and daddy for people who have issues. But it turns out that because South Africa is such a damaged society, you can't just do business. Yeah. You also have to be a big CSI operator. You also have to be conscious of people's transport problems, and you have to be aware of people's challenges of a financial nature, and perhaps you need to have someone who's a therapist in the business. HR is so complicated. So there's lots of this stuff that goes on that shouldn't be required, but in a society like ours is absolutely necessary.
It is,
and they can call you in to help negotiate their way through this stuff.
Well, what happens is you hit the nail on the head just now. You're saying as South Africans or corporate South Africa, we need to be aware of our heritage and what's happened before. That's why the Skills Act was put together, where we could balance the scale. So Africans, AICs now, Africans, Indians and Coloureds could now be educated where, you know, so cleaners and gardeners and drivers can now get an NQF qualification. So with them paying a skills development levy and government then rewarding them when they train and develop these people, and I have to add, white people are also included into that scale, so there's a place for all different demographics in learning and development. Sure. So now they've realized, okay, well, we're training these people. Let's train them on social cohesion. Let's train our managers in terms of how to speak to everybody on the team to drive them positively so that they can perform, but to be extremely aware that I have different people reporting to me.
Well, I mean, this is now everybody's problem, and I say problem not in terms of saying it's something we don't want to deal with, but it's something we do have to deal with, right? And it's a problem because it's a time-consuming thing, and it takes a huge amount of effort and consciousness.
And money.
And money. Mm. So everybody's involved because now the internet is everybody's place to unbundle themselves and to unburden themselves of all of their mental health issues. Yeah. So it's not just for employers. It's not just for government. It's not just for people who are interested in psychology and therapy. Mm. Because what we've got is we've got people screaming racism, classism, sexism, transgenderism, homophobia, intersexism, all kinds of stuff that these terms almost didn't exist some time ago. Certainly racism and classism and sexism did.
Yeah, even transgender. I mean, that's something that nobody knew how to spell.
Nobody knew how to spell this. Yeah. And these days, you know, we are led to believe by some on the extremes that someone can walk in one day and identify as a woman and the next day walk in and identify as a man. And somehow everyone else is required to know which pronouns to use, which is madness.
Yeah.
Just because it's a huge ask of someone else. But it's also increasingly becoming complicated because legislators and HR departments are now making this policy.
Yes.
So now it suddenly becomes about if you don't use the right pronoun for someone, you're an aggressor.
Mm.
You're actually a bad person and there are consequences for you.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not at the stage where Canada, for example, has made this law.
Mm.
But it certainly could become a situation of law for some South Africans. Has this got out of control?
Look, when we talk about these subjects, it's only someone else's problem. Transgender, homophobic, all those things, when it's someone else's child. So, for example, if the neighbor's child going through gender reassignment surgery, we can chuckle about it. The minute it's your own, then it becomes. So nobody really walks in. I mean, there were probably people who had a serious desire to change their gender 100 years ago. There were probably people who cross-dressed and people didn't quite understand what was it that was actually going on in my mind. You see, the thing is, depression and anxiety in South Africa that nobody talks about, a very, very large number of South African people within South African corporates, the modern South African community, more than 90% will suffer at some stage in their lives depression and anxiety. And they would feel a little bit sad through job loss, through divorce, children may be failing at school. There could be so many problems, you know. And corporates are now taking a very proactive stance. They're saying, how do we help you become the best individual that you can possibly be? Now, but if you're part of Employed South Africa, you can go to a training session. What about all those one in four, those millions of people don't work? People who don't have a policy and procedure to dictate.
Can you imagine how high suicide, anxiety, and depression are in that group?
Exactly. So when you don't have, a line that you can call to speak to a counselor, many big companies that we operate work with with.
Like a helpline.
They have the helpline. They have tip-offs anonymous for reporting fraud. They have support systems in place for leaders. They have LDP programs, leadership development programs that they're sending. So I'm almost saying that people in corporate South Africa are really gifted in terms of the tools they have available. Government rewards you, skills development levy. You get their money back when you train them. Government rewards you when there's a wellness program, HIV programs. What about the Joe Soap, the man on the street, who doesn't have access to these learning tools? And what we're saying is sometimes when we train you in corporate, you have the power to go back and educate your family, educate the church, educate the community. But it's not facilitated actually in the same way. So these challenges exist. The more corporate drive it, and I think government should be driving it too.
So your book is called Racism, Classism, Sexism, and Other Isms That Divide Us.
Mm.
Why did you write the book? Is it based on your experience doing the work that you've been doing?
Yes.
Tell me what the basic thrust of the book is.
Look, I wrote the book, firstly, your first question, based on experiences that I had. This book took me 4 years to write. And
It's work. It's
it is a lot of work, a lot of referencing.
A lot of research,
A lot of research. You see, Gareth, what happened was last year, in 2018, I sat in about 110%, I think it is, I must just check my figures, more corrective conduct disciplinary hearings around racially charged subjects than I ever did than I did the year before. And if I look at what I did 6 years ago, nobody was being hauled into a meeting or a grievance wasn't being lodged against you 6 years ago based on what you said. We just sort of like shoved it, you know, brushed it off.
So does that mean there's more racism, or does it mean we're more aware of it and people are more comfortable reporting it?
More aware of it and more comfortable because we have the channels
because
now
I can't believe we've become more racist. I mean, racism is discrimination, and usually by the powerful over the not powerful, but I mean it's usually government. And certainly in the kind of discrimination that we want to avoid in any country, in any free country in the world, is discrimination where certain people are given certain rules and other people are given other rules.
Yes.
That's the basic definition of racism.
Yeah.
So we've become a country that's a lot more egalitarian. The law treats everyone the same, you would think.
Mm.
You would hope. Companies are held to the same standard. You've got to treat everybody equally. So it can't be that there is more racism than there was in 1963 apartheid South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Or in even 1993 South African apartheid South Africa.
Mm.
There can't be more racism.
Mm-hmm.
But our attitudes to each other seem to be, and certainly if you read the media, and if I take your experience of last year's disciplinary hearings into, that it seems like it's a bigger problem than it's ever been.
Mm. You see, we spoke about this a little bit about the conversation with the self. How tolerant are you, or me, or him? How tolerant are we in a multicultural society, in a corporate space at the moment? Am I cohesive enough to consider your opinion? People's levels of tolerance, our threshold for stupid things people saying these days, or our threshold, we're becoming a lot quicker to respond, a lot quicker to react, and I'm not necessarily understanding your point of view. So I'll take it on the surface, and I call it blatant racism, and then I can lodge a grievance. We had an instance where one white manager, the call center manager, asked the accounts manager, do you know of a good domestic worker? Now, she's African, South African, black South African. He is white South African. And he asked her, do you know of a domestic worker? Somebody looking for a job at the moment, because we don't have one. And then she said, well, you know, I'm not so sure. And he says, anyone, you know, sister, relative, whatever's looking, then, you know, we could get up. You know, if we could meet. And then she said, oh, my sister, no, she's got a doctorate, so I don't think she's going to be a very expensive cleaner for you, you know, if a domestic worker for you. They two chuckled about it.
Mm.
So they chuckled about it, and whether she was offended or not, we don't know, because I wasn't there. I was just sat in and mediated this thing now. And somebody else overheard the discussion and went to HR and lodged a grievance against what the man had said.
But you're not allowed to be offended on someone else's behalf. The law even doesn't see that.
Right. So what happened was they went
You're not allowed to be upset on behalf of someone else. This is something some people don't understand.
Well, whether or not she was allowed to, the fact is she became vocal about it. Mm. So in the real sense of the word, so whether we prohibited by saying certain things, people still say they have clandestine meetings. You know, you try and get people on sides. So what happens is we'll sit in a meeting, we'll smile and nod, but the minute we finish the meeting, we'll go outside and have a meeting about the meeting, about what the manager said, what he said, what she said. And we have these little clandestine groups in the parking lot at the water cooler.
Or on WhatsApp.
Or on WhatsApp groups, etc. So she spoke to her HR manager about it. And then her HR manager said, you know, what offended you about this? And they were just generally speaking. And it turned out, as a result of that, others had, and she tried to drum up some level of support. It's actually a horrible story, really. Nothing had happened to the particular man, but he had been spoken to, and the company then had to go through a massive intervention to try and speak to this particular challenge. What is it that you're saying? What am I hearing? Did we necessarily take the time? What did you mean by that? You know, why doesn't your white sister, you know, what did you really mean by that? I mean, how does it...
It's like an Inquisition, a Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
Like, what do you really believe? We can read your true intentions.
Exactly.
Convert or die.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
And what that does to the team, it almost divides us even further.
Well, that guy's never going to make a joke again. It doesn't allow for conversation to flow. There's no cohesion, as you point out. And everybody's looking each other askance. This is what the Soviet Union was all about, is you're telling on your neighbor.
There you go. And the funny thing is, many African people who hear the story will say, but unemployment is a big problem. You should be asking somebody, do they know of somebody who's looking for a job?
Yeah.
This is a very normal dialogue to facilitate. Yeah. But the person's level of self-esteem, where they're sitting right now, we don't know what pushed their button and what they are offended by now.
But Devin, in these situations, shouldn't someone sensible come in and go, listen, the woman who laid the complaint, who wasn't involved in the conversation, she just overheard it.
Mm.
Honey, you need some therapy, and this is not your problem.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you're not allowed. It is completely disingenuous of you to project your problems onto society as a whole or onto this company to make us spend money and time trying to investigate something which is your problem.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do this. I mean, cooler heads must prevail in these situations.
Look, and this is the initiative that most organizations are taking before it even starts to have the dialogue around what is perceived racism, what is levels of self-esteem. So most training sessions will go like this. We'll say, Dumelang, Salamu Alaikum, why do people wear hijab? This does nothing. What we need to do, it does nothing.
Because if people are interested, they'll look it up
anyway. Yeah, they'll look it up anyway. So whether I know how to greet in 11 or so many languages, it doesn't make me less of a racist than I was before. What we need to do is dig deeper, have a real dialogue about how I actually see you. How do I actually see the team? How cohesive am I? So to dig deeper, to ask questions about my leadership style and attribute.
But Devin, is the company, is the workplace the right environment for that?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know we have family problems in South Africa, right? We have, as I said earlier, a destructed, destroyed, broken society. Mm. And people are looking for belonging.
Mm-hmm.
The workplace is a place where everyone has agreed you're getting paid to be there.
Mm.
And you want to be happy and you want to be challenged and you want to have success and you want to have a feeling of utility, and there's lots of other stuff that's very important in the workplace. Mm. But it sounds to me also like the workplace has now got to step in and be a proxy family, like our universities have become a proxy family for students who come from broken and disheveled homes.
Yeah.
That they need to feel like someone else is going to be their mommy or their daddy.
Mm.
And is that really a company's job?
You see, where it becomes high on the agenda for organizations is when you are in the service industry. So most organizations who are dealing with other people. So I've noticed the trend. So when we have people who are in technical roles, they generally don't focus on human components of development as much as people who are companies that are focused on service delivery.
So that would be like engineers.
Yes.
Or doctors.
Yeah. We very seldom go into facilitate leadership dialogue around a group of IT technicians who are programming. And they generally seldom, I know it sounds like quite a, it's a, like I'm generalizing, but this is my experience.
Sure.
Yeah, we generally don't have a group of IT professionals.
So which departments in a company are usually where these kinds of activities take
place. Where there's customer interface and where there's frequent interaction and engagement with other staff members, my productivity determined by your productivity and our cohesion and how we're engaging and how we're discussing. So service-related organizations, casinos, banks, mm-hmm. Those types of things. So,
and is there a split between men and women in terms of who are mostly complaining and who are mostly complained about? Along gender lines?
If I reflect on some of what we've done, no, I'd say it's pretty even. So I would say it's
men
pretty
and
balanced.
Women complain as much as each other.
Pretty
South Africans complain a lot. Let's
generally, our complainers, people even think up racist. We'll even imagine somebody being a racist when we wait in a queue too long.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so some people generally tend to do things like that.
We do. I mean, like, we like to, and because of our history, we've been conditioned, we've been brainwashed to believe in groupthink, mm-hmm. and to believe that a whole group of people is against us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're black and we see a bunch of white people, they must be talking about us. If we're white and we see a bunch of black people, they must be talking about us.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost conspiratorial.
Mm-hmm. Look, I think it's not just a South African cultural trait. I think it happens globally.
If we see a group of Muslim people, we imagine that they're conspiring.
Yeah, the Americans, you know? Australians,
sure.
You know, with Aboriginally people. There are people generally around the world that experience this type of marginalization. But my question is, where does it actually occur? Is it in your mind or is it actually occurring right now?
And so what is the question? I mean, I'm going to play a clip from Stephen Fry, which I'm sure you've heard a million times because it comes into your article in the title.
Offense. It's now very common to hear people say, I'm rather offended by that, as if that gives them certain rights. It's actually nothing more. It's simply a whine. It's no more than a whine.
I find that so offensive.
I find that offensive. It has no meaning. It has no purpose. It has no reason to be respected as a phrase. I am offended by that. Well, so fucking what? I mean,
right?
You know.
I mean, this is probably the position of a lot of people. So fucking what? You're offended. But clearly that's not how corporate South Africa responds or how people in government respond.
Because growth of revenue and growth of market share will go down. So the minute people are offended by something, then the bottom line is affected. So we may not see it immediately in terms of loss of revenue, but people have options at the moment. So companies are trying to portray themselves as an extremely sensitive organization who cares about you. How do we do this? You know? And what do? We focused on CSI. We do diversity and inclusion training. Our people are well taken care of. Yeah. And therefore, how could it happen? There should never be any form
utopia.
Of
utopia.
Correct. Because it eats in. You can choose where you want to buy a car. And usually people will go and buy a car from the dealership that they're most comfortable with engaging with the people, not necessarily the IT system. So there are certain people-centric businesses will buy from other people. So some people even drive another kilometer to go fill petrol at one petrol station versus another because they just like the cashier a little bit more.
Yeah.
People do that.
Yes, they do. Mm. And similarly, people like to jump to a conclusion. You mentioned this a little earlier in a different example, but we like to say that person's good or that person's bad, but very binary, because we mostly, especially if we interact with like the cashier at the petrol station, it's a very superficial interaction.
Yeah.
Right. You're not actually asking them about their children or what their life story up to now is, what their personal experiences have been. You don't have time and they don't have time. And frankly, not everybody needs to engage at that level.
No.
But we do like to jump to conclusions about whether someone's a good or a bad person. I overheard a guy in a restaurant being very rude to the waiter, and I decided that must be a bad person. But I don't know whether he had a bad day.
No,
I don't know whether his wife's just divorced him. I don't know whether he's being abused by his boss. I don't know whether his children are on drugs and he's very concerned about them and he's taking that out on the waiter.
Yeah.
But now, of course, all of this has played out in a much bigger world of social media and of corporate culture and all of this stuff. So how do we remind ourselves to be conscientious about our words and about our behavior?
It's a good question, and I like the examples you're using. Within our same subcultures, within our same cultural groups, African on African racism, Indian on Indian, white on white. For example, she's beautiful for a dark girl.
I've heard this before, yeah.
Yeah, yellow bone people. When I was at a wedding and the most gorgeous looking girl walked down the aisle, I mean, she was really about 17 years old. She was a bridesmaid. one of five of them, wearing a pink peach dress. And then the aunt looked over at me and she said, "Ooh," because she could see I was smiling at the girl. I was just in awe of how stunning this little girl looked. And the aunt looked over and said, "Ooh, she's beautiful, nah, for a dark girl." And here's me looking like, you know, like charcoal next to you.
Well, so, we know. I mean, we can talk Indian. In India, there's huge
levels of colorism.
And the caste systems, hangovers. But in South Africa, too, you have Durban Indians, you have Joburg Indians. You have dark, you have light.
Exactly.
If someone brings home a slightly lighter girlfriend or boyfriend, the mother carries on like Jesus has just entered the room.
Exactly. And even body shaving, an example. That girl now, who may have heard or may not have heard the aunt saying she's beautiful for a dark girl.
Mm.
That particular girl may be first in line at a pharmacy to give her hydroquinine, which is going to damage her skin because South Africa, never mind land expropriation without compensation, my friend. People are spending billions on skin lightening creams intravenously.
Look at black women and hair. We don't even go there.
We don't even go there. That is a clear example. Clear example of prejudicial behavior within our communities. Some women are not comfortable without going outside without a weave. Some people are not comfortable without taking an injectable so that you could bring your levels of glutathione up so that melanin production stops. That's the lens we're going through, Gareth.
Self-harm.
And you know how it's about maybe R1,000 a pop to get an injection. Celebrities are now on the front page of magazines going, to be good looking, you've got to be light skinned, you've got to be this certain body shape. So it's got to be, we've got to be aware of what am I projecting right now. If my kid came out a little bit chubby and as dark as I am, what is he on the back foot already? Is that the true definition of success in this world? So you're telling me that because you're light-skinned, because you've got this shape of frame, because you're very athletic built and you're cute, you've got a better advantage. Look at all of our world leaders who've made a real difference in the planet. Not by, let's try, are they going to be cover models?
No.
Do we have posters?
Hardly ever.
You understand where I'm coming from. So it needs to be a conversation we have with ourselves in that moment. The aunt who said she's beautiful for a dark girl. Oh, the groom was cute, man, for a fat guy. Chubby? Shame, but cute. You know, that type of thing.
And this is within families, let alone communities, let alone race groups.
Exactly.
So our prejudices go very, very deep.
It
and
does.
They get very close to home.
It does. Grandmothers can't even go into your house. Oh, you've gained.
Well, listen, I used to tease my brother because my sister and I are blonde and he's got dark hair and we used to say he was adopted.
Mm.
And that's inside the family. I mean, that's not very nice.
Well, look, I mean, maybe that's that.
Maybe for all I know, he cried himself to sleep a few nights. I don't know.
Who knows? But, you know, maybe he did. But you see, we're not ready to speak about this, about body shaming. So somebody, I'm sure they know they have a pear-shaped body. And now aunts are pointing it out. You've got to wear that jacket for your pear shape. You've got to cover everything up. And people openly say things like that. And it's about being aware. And, I mean, who says light skin is better? Who says a thin frame is better? Some men enjoy a woman with a voluptuous body.
But how is it received is important, right?
Mm.
How is it received? Because, again, it's so subjective. You've got some people who are like fat and happy about being fat and don't care what anyone thinks. And you can say anything to them and they use it as part of their routine.
Mm.
They might be genuinely unhappy at some level, but they're not offended by that stuff.
Mm.
To them, it's like, you know, it's when people criticize me for looking a certain way or whatever.
Yeah.
It doesn't really bother me, but I've come to terms with a lot of things about myself that are weak or that are not necessarily my best. Aspects, my best characteristics. Some people, however, don't take these things very well, and it does trigger in them a very visceral reaction, and it can make them harm themselves.
Yeah.
And you don't know. The fact is you don't know when you're saying something.
Mm.
But what it can do, if you're too self-aware and you're too conscious about this and you're too careful and sanitize everything, that there's actually no real communication.
Yeah.
Everything's platitudes.
You know, a very real example, Gareth, and I'm glad you're bringing it up here because we don't know how you're internalizing it. Yes, I could make the comment about your skin color. I could make the comment about your weight.
And you might even laugh.
You might even laugh about it. You could have battled a thyroid problem for years and years. I don't know what's going on the inside, okay? And the reality is that some of us are not as sensitive as we should be. It was my birthday 3 weeks ago. My partner and I on the same day, on the 26th of Jan, and my family treated us to a lovely dinner. And the food took about 2.5 hours.
Please don't tell me they stereotyped and made Indian food.
No, it was actually, it was curry, it was a lovely biryani, it was a stunning,
yeah,
parathas. So, and you know, I'm mentioning it now because, you know, I'm talking to you very candidly and real
sure,
here.
Go on.
This, the manager of the store, he, I don't know whether I should be mentioning it,
no,
but perhaps I should. Yeah. You know, he was under a lot of pressure that evening. He looked like he was under a lot of pressure. And he was pacing and he, you know, the food had taken 2.5 hours to get out. And, well, look, we said nothing. We just carried on. It was a birthday. We had a fantastic conversation. But there were tempers flaring, you know, between the kitchen, between the waiters. Gareth, you'll never believe it. On Tuesday, and I'm in this field, I'm understanding people's anxieties. I know depression is real at the moment. I don't know what the straw was that broke the camel's back. He committed suicide on Tuesday.
Jesus.
Put an absolute dampener on my whole mood because, I mean, it was my birthday on the Saturday.
How dare he ruin your birthday by killing himself?
How dare you? But the point is that how aware are we in terms of another person's? It's not like I should have said there's nothing that we could have done because suicide, depression, and anxiety is a buildup of years and years of different levels, you know, how we perceive ourselves. But we don't know. Saying that to a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, enhances the perception of the individual.
Well, it's Teen Suicide Prevention Week, so this is very apposite.
Yeah, absolutely. They're girls sticking their fingers in their throats to try and look a certain way because we are telling you you've got to be this in order to be accepted by that. And it's the message that's being communicated by friends, by relatives, by mums, by dads, by aunts and uncles.
There's got to be an element of human resilience here too. Mm. I mean, there is no way that any 14-year-old, despite all the predations of social media and all of the things in society that make it hard for you to live as a young girl or a young guy, but particularly young girls, because they're much more susceptible to this kind of bullying, and it goes on all over on social media. There is no way that a young 14-year-old girl now has a harder life than three generations ago. There's no way. There's absolutely the girl of three generations ago was living in real danger almost every minute of her life.
Mm.
Real mortal danger. Danger of sexual predators, danger of actual things that wanted to eat her, people who wanted to kill her. She was totally at the mercy of the men in her life, blah, blah, blah. She was a possession, in fact, in many societies.
Mm.
So let's not pretend that the girl of 14 now is dealing in real terms with as dangerous a society as her grandmother might have grown up in. And yet her grandmother survived.
Yeah. Yes, I completely understand.
I mean, there's an element of resilience we have to build into this. Otherwise, we're all snowflakes.
Yeah, they were races before. There was depression and anxiety before. We're not saying there wasn't.
There was slavery before.
There was slavery before. So people had it extremely difficult at a certain part. All different we had our challenges.
I mean, if you went back in time and you told a woman of, let's say, the late 1800s, that there was this thing where girls were being told that they have to look a certain way, she'd laugh you out of the room.
Mm.
She'd say, I'm terribly sorry to listen to your problems, but I have got to go to the workhouse, and I've got a 23-hour shift of making stuff with my hands to get through.
Yeah,
and then I've got children to look after.
Exactly. She'd probably laugh it off. Yeah. However, we're living in an era where information is at the fingertips. We should be more aware. If there was depression 10 years ago, depression 20, 30 years ago, and there was, there must have been. If people were committing suicide then, people are certainly committing suicide now, and people handle it and deal with it in a different way. How as a society and as a nation are we going to grow if we do not become intrinsically aware of how I'm communicating?
No, we've got to move better.
We absolutely have to move better in that space.
So let's talk, because we touched basically on racism and sexism to a slightly lesser degree, but classism is a whole different one. And that's an area I think that is completely unexplored because people just gloss over it. Like it's just an economic reality. Or worse, it's a question of what you're born into.
Yeah. Well, in this case, it's if you're driving a Merc or you're driving a BM, you park right outside the church on a Sunday. You take a selfie, you know, hashtag church, hashtag Jesus, and then you
blessed.
You're blessed. Hashtag blessed. If you're driving a Ferrari, you park inside the church. Yes. You know, that kind of situation.
Right. So, and to God.
Even the imam or the mullah or the pastor, they park in parking bay number 4. You know, so there's this perception. Rich relatives get dished food first at the wedding or the party.
Is that what happens?
Yeah, it does happen. Huh. We have our brothers
really,
and sisters
the rich
here.
People get, so rich people in South Africa
Even at weddings and parties, I'm not even talking about shopping centers and how sometimes just a simple glance over, where your oldest, okay, maybe they'll recognize you in that store, but where your oldest, send one of your colleagues in, wearing something that they will never suggest, they'll never be able to afford something in that particular store of Canton City. And let's see how much engagement there
is. I love that. I do that all the time. Dress as badly as I can.
Then you experience it firsthand.
No, I mean,
people still recognize
me. No. Well, no, what I do is I'm actively looking to see how they, because I did it once at a car dealership. I wanted to go and buy a car, and I had serious intentions about it, but I tried to underdress, and this was before anyone really knew. I wasn't doing TV or whatever. Mm. And it is interesting. People do treat you very differently.
That's classism in motion.
Yeah, you go in a suit.
Yeah, that's classism in motion. Yeah. Classism in motion.
But it's the same for a job interview.
Yeah,
I mean, you dress up for a job interview.
I would say so. And if I feel that you and I have golfing in common, and we talk about golf, intrinsically we have a connection. That's classism in motion. What if you like baking and I just love golf? I'm measuring you how. So sometimes we box and we stay. So the rich poor thing. So sometimes people who grew up with Uncle, Fani for years and years and years won't invite him to the wedding because, you know, they're very common. Yes. You know, he drinks a lot. He'll never. But I mean, and then you're ducking him at the local spa.
There's a lot more of that, I assume, in like white suburbia.
Yes. So now, so we'll have 30 intimate people. African people subscribe to Spirit of Ubuntu. We'll have like maybe 500 people. Indian people have 1,500 people at their weddings. So then
I've been to one or two, I know.
White people will go with, 30 of our closest friends and family. Or, Michaela, don't play with her. She's very common.
Yeah.
You know, poverty will rub off on you. You know, those types of things. And it's the real South African dialogues we're having.
Oh, yeah.
People hear people say things like that. So the uncle you grew up with your whole life, he doesn't make the grade to be invited to your posh wedding in Maldives Drift because he's too poor. Yes. I mean, his car doesn't fit the profile. Yeah. What would our friends say? That's classism in motion.
Sure.
And I experience classism a lot because I just do. My partner's a white person.
Yeah.
And the way, people treat, the bill always comes to the white person. I experience classism.
That's outrageous.
It is outrageous. In Thailand, even. I was ignored because Indians are poor. They were the cleaners there. So I was completely ignored. That's classism in motion. But they fall over themselves to help the European person.
Well, maybe just because they're assuming there's a tip in that.
Maybe
it's just pure stuff.
Yeah, well, I've got no money versus what money my partner has.
Mind you could be more. You could be far richer.
Well, actually, if they really knew, they would have tripped over themselves to help me.
But this could be a source of tremendous social cohesion because it can be a source of humor.
Mm.
It can be a source of us sharing our experiences, even if they're very different, to have real conversations, which is meaningful. So you get to know someone.
Yeah.
And if you understand where someone's from, you're likely to get along with them than if you don't understand where they're from.
Yeah. The other thing
is, keep putting your foot in it. Do we really want to get to know each other?
It's not about really wanting to get to know each other. The thing is, Gareth, we have to coexist in society. We can do it by two ways. We can push you away, very far away, so that you don't look twice at me when I desperately need help. And we're living in a society at the moment where we have to be very aware that we're part of a global, we're a global citizen.
Yeah, but
really,
it's easier than ever to be an individual as well.
It's so easy.
You can completely remove yourself. You can be self-reliant. You can live far away from everyone else. There are hermits. And that was never possible before, because if you were thrown out of the tribe in Cro-Magnon and Australopithecus days, you were dead.
Look, if the stake is not high, it doesn't matter. So nobody cares whether you greet them or not at a mall. Nobody cares whether you greet the petrol attendant or not. That's irrelevant. But where it does matter is when we're treating somebody differently, when the stakes are high based on whether they're going to make the purchase or not, based on whether the customer comes back or not.
Or so whether as a business you're able to function better or
correct.
Worse.
Correct. That's the whole English Afrikaans thing, another level of classism. The guy comes in, I want to speak to somebody who can speak Afrikaans. I don't speak Afrikaans. Let me get somebody who will be able to help you. That's again classism. We should all know Goeiemôre. We should all know Exal Probeer. And this actually happened at one of our clients where an African man from Langa then came forward, a Sotho guy, and said to him, Meneer, Exal Probeer, my Afrikaans is so good. He ended up buying 2 A-class Mercs for his kids who started varsity at Stellenbosch. The first guy lost that moment of contact, that customer interface, where he could have got the sale. But that's where it becomes the stakes are high. You lost your commission, you lost the sale.
I want to ask you about a situation I observed the other day, and you tell me what's going on here. So a black woman's at the counter at the shop, mm-hmm. right? I'm paying at the next door till, so I'm just overhearing this.
Okay.
A guy, another black man with a big trolley full of stuff comes up to the counter with her, and he says to her, here's my card or whatever, and here, let's pay. And it's all in English, so I can understand this. And then she says to him in Zulu, which I could just understand this. She says to him, why don't you speak Zulu? Oh. He said, please, if you want to get ahead in this world, you can't speak in English now.
Oh.
You can't speak Zulu. Zulu is for the poor people, and I'm not going to speak Zulu. There's a black man to a black woman.
Oh.
I'm not going to speak Zulu. My children are only speak English, and the only two things that matter in the world are power and money, and language is not important, and our languages are stupid. This is what he's saying to her. And she was kind of, I could see she was shocked by this. And by that stage, I couldn't really pay attention because it would have looked like I was paying attention.
Yeah.
It was none of my business.
Yes.
But I thought this was an interesting, and he was doing it loud. Like he was obviously happy for other people to hear.
I see.
And I could see she was shocked and a little bit ashamed of the interchange that was taking place.
Mm.
What's really going on there?
Yeah, this is him projecting his own anxieties, his own level of self-esteem. You could greet someone in Arabic. You could greet someone in Zulu or Sotho. It doesn't make you less of a leader. And there are leaders in the world who would go out of their way to try and appreciate and understand another person's culture. We see Christian leaders worshipping at a church, at a mosque or a temple. We see them engaging with Buddhist people. Why? In an effort for us to bridge social divides. So if we're saying to that woman, you're disrespecting her ancestors, you're disrespecting her mother tongue, you're disrespecting where she's come from based on your own phobia and your fear and your anxieties around speaking English. English is not the be-all, end-all language. That is your perception of it. It would have cost you nothing to say Dumelang. Would have cost you nothing to say, you know, Sabona to the lady. Because that's her interpretation.
It's so odd. And, you know, there was another guy listening who was laughing, who obviously thought this was funny.
Mm.
Happened to be another black guy. But it's just the kind of interaction. We tend to think also that this is very unique, but it happens all over the world, right?
Mm.
And it's not a purely South African experience.
I want to throw it back to you and ask you the question. Gareth, who would have been your leader if that same thing had happened and you got the lecture about how English is the be-all, end-all, and it speaks to rich and being famous or whatever his idea was, and another person who politely said, oh, Sabona sister, who was maybe a white man, or who's your leader? Who's the person that you would have gravitated
to? Well, no, I don't think it's a leadership thing. Okay. I think it's just manners.
Okay,
and obviously the person, the latter, not the former.
There you go. So who would you
perceive
as... that's
just a person, that's just it's manners.
That's manners.
I mean, like if someone says Sawubona to me, I say Yebo Sawubona back.
Okay.
If someone says to me Goeiemôre, I try to say Goeiemôre back.
Right.
I mean, I might go good morning in a lapse of judgment, but it's not because I'm trying to be offensive.
Mm. Now, because you're a human like I am, like everybody else is, we all are making almost instantaneous decisions in terms of who we want to respect right now and who we don't. Who I will feel comfortable to say, will you help me with this bag, please, my hands are really sore. Or who I will just rather suffer in silence and carry my own shopping bags. You see what I'm saying? We are making these informed decisions all the time. And based on our behavior, we are then able to then identify and separate who I can gravitate towards and who I can't. And that's happening all over.
I love this. The book is called Racism, Classism, Sexism, and Other Isms That Divide Us. Devin Munsami, well done on writing the book, and congratulations on the good work that you're doing in South Africa.
Thank you, Gareth.
I hope we're becoming... There is no way that being more conscious could be bad.
Oh.
And there's no way that being more polite to each other could be bad.
Oh, yes.
And there's no way that being respectful to other people rather than just tolerant could be bad.
Mm.
But at the same time, let's also have a sense of humor about ourselves and not project all our shit onto other people.
Mm.
I mean, do you think that's fair? Is there a way that we can find this happy medium?
Yeah, look, I think the best way we can do it is identifying before we make the statement, and as you call it, projecting all of your insecurities and your inhibitions. Before we project, we must reflect on what it is I'm going to say, and how does it impact the situation right now, how high are the stakes, and what are the possible causes and effects of this in the future. I'm of the opinion that many people are making statements on social media, many people are saying things that they haven't properly properly been able to reflect on what the possible consequences are. So actually, it leaves things, it just exposes you on a whole different level, and it may not even necessarily be in the intention, in the pursuit of more followers, in the pursuit of having a voice, in the pursuit of people seeing you as a thought leader. No, there are other things to do. Social cohesion, bringing us closer, so we can do those things.
I like it very much.
Yeah.
Get the book. Where can we get the book, by the way?
Oh, you can log on to you can get it at bookstores.
Have you got a website?
Yes, devinmunsami.com and ichiftraining.co.za. In fact, you can buy it off devinmunsami.com.
Yeah, let's do that. Devin is with a D-E-V-A-N.
Yes.
Munsami. Moon, and you know how to spell moon. If you don't, then you shouldn't buy the book because you won't be able to read it. And Sammy, S-A-M-Y.
Thank you, Gareth.
Very nice to see you.
Thank you.
Cool. This is CliffCentral.com.